All right, fuck, it's Monday morning. Greetings, you happily miserable accursed. It's Hurley here, and with me is the political panel, those lovely pundits who you either want to hug or hurl an ashtray at. And not just any ashtray. I'm talking about one of those weighty glass ashtrays your Aunt Fanny had on the living room table in 1973. The injurious kind. Jordan Leichnitz is here. Corey Tanaik is here. And Scott Reed is here, belatedly. Today on the pod, we're going to talk about a certain level of political hate out there. Trudeau and Belleville, is this the kind of fuck you treatment ahistorical? Is it unique to him? What are the antecedents, if anything? Poilievre had a weird week this week. The story about the paid-up legal fees for the Patrick Brown whistleblower and the tiny little shack apology. It's probably not the way they laid out this week on the summer tour plan. And our cursed clipping is Tonda Macharles' piece in the Star on Trudeau's imminent cabinet shuffle. We'll talk less about the moving pieces and more about what's behind the curtain here. Why was this story even leaked? And then the glorious Gordon Pinsent will be by to drop in and herald our Hey Yous. Corey, Scott, Jordan, how are you? Jordan, how was your weekend?
It was good. I was camping in Algonquin, which had beautiful views and mosquitoes so large they could carry you off. So it's good. I am now glad to be home in my air-conditioned house.
What does camping mean precisely? How roughing it were you?
In a tent.
Already sucks. Irredeemably sucks.
Well, it's a joke in our family because so my partner and his family immigrated to Canada in the 90s and his family, extended family, doesn't sort of share the joy of the outdoors that he has cultivated, and their quip is often, if you're sleeping in a tent, that means things have gone very wrong. So we came here to avoid that. No, we had a good time. It was very nice. There was not a lot of people up there. Highly recommended, especially for those of us who work in politics. It's nice to be away from people for a while.
Hmm. Well, Corey, have you recovered from Saturday night?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I had a great weekend. I had a kind of an impromptu late evening with you and Terry and Nicole on Saturday, which was fantastic. Great bands and a sizable number of rum and cokes for you and I.
And I think about 4:30, we finalized the CPP, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. We got heavily into CPP policy and a bunch of other things at 3 a.m. when you're shit faced, because that's definitely the time to do it. And then last night I had an equally nice evening of conversation with Nicole's sister and brother-in-law, and you know. Great fun. Lots of great conversations. A lot less drinking, though, on the Sunday night than the Saturday night, fortunately.
Scott, everybody's cheery. You're going to have to bring us down with your existential angst.
Yeah, well, I have plenty. First of all, the camping thing. Okay, like once they have innovated technologically, there's no reason to go back. Like once they said, well, you know what? We've built shelters. Like we have created cottages, actual homes. You go like, well, why go back to the tent? Like let's not, never look back, never reverse. It makes no sense to me, right?
It's I always feel that way about chopsticks, you know?
That's the old Jerry Seinfeld shtick.
I gotta say, I wish more people in Toronto had your attitude, Scott, because I'm sick of competing with them for campsites. So keep spreading the gospel down there.
Secret to getting a good campsite is you just have to be like 100 yards away from a parking spot, or you know, one and a half a lake in from the boat launch. Because as soon as it's that tiny bit more difficult to get to the campsite, nobody goes, in comparison.
We have a cottage without air conditioning, and like I'll bail at that place if it's above 20 degrees at night. I'm like, sorry, we can't stay. Right? Won't be comfortable. I'm going to be tossing and turning.
We're just more prepared for the climate apocalypse than you are, so we'll see you up there, you know?
I will say happily that today is the birthday of one of my 4 to 7 sons. My son number 3, Benny, turns 14 today, Dave. He's getting big, 14, and I'm getting old.
Right. That's a good age, just before the cynicism fully sets in.
Yeah.
One last year of believing in Brendan Gallagher.
He fully believes in Brendan Gallagher. He is in the front pew in that church.
All right. Speaking of your background, Scott.
Okay.
Speaking of your background, you're from Belleville.
I am.
You're from Belleville. So you got any thoughts about what happened to the PM in your town the other day?
Yeah, I got a bunch. Like, first of all, it pisses me off. This visit actually had a little weird connection in a couple ways for me. So, you know, first of all, like, I don't know how many of those people are from the area and how many people shipped in. There's all kinds of forensic photographs being taken of some asshole in another fucking moron, and they're tracking them down. This guy lives in Scarborough and she's from wherever the hell. So I take it, I take it on faith that a lot of those folks that were following the prime minister and disrupting things in the market square weren't necessarily there. They're just a professional. They're like, you know, they're the deadheads. They're the fuckheads, right? You know, they just follow the prime minister around, hurl gravel and invective. I know this. I know that it bothers me, and it's a reflection of our times. And I know, I know one of the things you hear all the time is people will push back and go, well, then he shouldn't be such a divisive prime minister. He gets what he asked for. And then the other response you get is, well, this has happened to all sorts of prime ministers. I don't think so. Like, I think that lots of protesters have followed lots of various prime ministers. God knows his dad got it in spades. And, you know, Paul would occasionally get protested here or there. But I think this kind of this ugliness, people with flags that are upside down, the fuck Trudeau signs, the throwing gravel. And, you know, one thing is, it just so happened they did an event this weekend in Belleville. Aside from that, in the market square where they had to kind of basically exit because it was so unpleasant. And the prime minister went and met with a couple of young families and talked about child benefits and child care, all that kind of stuff. And just by fluke, it turns out my cousin was invited by one of her friends who had been invited to host this thing. So she goes to the thing. And it just, it puts it all in perspective for me because two things. One, I was talking to my cousin's mom and dad on Saturday when I was back at the cottage. They were back there too. And they're all conservatives, okay? All my family are conservatives. And they were struck, right? They were struck by the fact that even at this house where they were hosting three young families, there are people who show up and they park on the front lawn across the street. And they're screaming, fuck Trudeau, fuck this. And one of the dads in the neighborhood comes over and says, listen, I got no truck or trade for Trudeau. I don't care about politics. But shut the fuck up. Quit screaming fuck in front of my kids. Quit screaming, you know, showing an upside down flag. It's like, that's not cool. Like, just get lost, you losers. And then they're like, fuck you. We have a right to be here. And all this. And it's just, there's just such an ugly social media fueled, I have a right to be intolerant. And if you're intolerant of my intolerance, you're the asshole. And I don't know what to do about it, but it's terrible. I think of my cousin's grandmother, my great aunt Marg, who inspired a love of politics in me. She was a dyed-in-the-wool conservative, came from Belleville, lived in Belleville her whole life, worked for every conservative leader that during her adult lifetime. And I know she would have said, I got no time for this. And it's just part and parcel of our politics now, but I really take a dim view on those who go, you know what, 'twas ever thus and no big deal. It is a big deal. Like, if we can't abide by basic common standards of decency, then we've let something really slide and we should say no. Like, no, it's just not, it's not cool, and we should object to it no matter who the prime minister is or who the party is.
But did you object to it when it was fuck Harper signs and people?
Yes,
doing
I did. And I'm
thing?
On the record. You bet. When the page blew out, you know, and held up the sign in the House of Commons, I didn't say, oh, well, Harper had it coming and that's kosher. I thought it was inappropriate. And I said so.
Well, Corey, what's your point, though? Do you think it's the same?
I think it's very similar. It's maybe not exactly identical. I think that there's some of this that's a little more superheated with respect to the pandemic and with respect to this sort of cheap karaoke version of U.S. politics that you often see up here, where people are trying to parrot, you know, whether it's the MAGA stuff or whether it's trying to parrot Obama stuff or whatever, but we often see these sort of cultural or media echoes of the same sort of thing that's going on in the U.S. But it's kind of this cheesy Me Too-ism of obviously a different nature. But that's not what I find interesting about this, David. And we're talking about this on Saturday night together a bit. What I find interesting is the reaction of the target of this and how different leaders interact with these sorts of crowds in different ways, and that it's very much, I think, a reflection of their personality, and sometimes not an altogether positive one. Like, if you're to look at Harper's reaction to all of the fuck Harper stuff that was going on of a similar nature. It was basically to try to create a hermetically sealed campaign whereby he and no media camera would ever see any of that. It made him uncomfortable. He didn't like to be confronted by anyone with a different, you know, point of view in that kind of forum. Like, there was a way, a time and space to engage with those people, but it wasn't, you know, wasn't having them disrupt an event or whatever. And so incredible efforts made to essentially avoid the public at all costs, which is, I got to say, not a great way to campaign. But that was his approach. I think for Trudeau, he has an instinct to go and tweak the nose of these people more than Harper ever did, and in a way that is meeting their fuck you with a fuck you right back. And I don't know, I just find it interesting. I just comment that I think that's what he does. Like, he is more apt to get into a verbal confrontation with a protester or someone who disagrees with him. And you know, my personal opinion is I think that makes it worse. I think it's the same thing.
Can you expand on that for a second? Because I read something about along these lines this morning in The Line. I think it was Jen Gearson maybe that wrote it. And Jen, if it wasn't you, I apologize. But in an article that made a number of different points about this, one of them they were making was that they seem to think, as in the 2021 election campaign, that the Trudeau tour operation is somehow complicit in these events, that it welcomes them in a sense because it likes the contrast and it creates events in which this is possible. That doesn't feel valid to me, but is it?
I think there's an element that is probably true, because it is absolutely his choice to go and get in an argument with some young kid on abortion policy in a way that is very social media friendly. Like, they certainly have sook this out from time to time. And I think, you know, trying to say, like, look, the people who are against me are these, you know, screaming idiots and people not wanting to be affiliated with that. I don't know. I'd be very curious to see what the research on that looks like, because I think there's some other things that might not be intended that have a very negative effect on your campaign. Sometimes people are tired of just the noise and conflict, and they want to have some peace.
Can I just intervene real quick before Jordan goes and says something thoughtful to say that I dislike that argument and I reject it. I really strongly think that's just, that is something people say as a justification for the way that that he's being treated. I don't know if it's qualitatively different. I think it's qualitatively different. But when people say indirectly, look, he had it coming and he brings it on himself, I don't think that's true. I don't think it's fair. And I don't think that I don't think it's anybody who disagrees with him. I think these people are qualitatively different than folks who disagree. They're not just registering their objection. They're harassing others that are also around. People couldn't go into the market square. It happens over and over again. And I think that you should to say, well, you know what, therefore the prime minister should stay indoors and not engage with anyone. I just think that's horseshit. I'm not going to reward the idiots.
Look, Scott, I'll let me finish before you do the critique. I'm not saying it's justified. I'm saying what I find is interesting is I think they're actually very much the same. Maybe one's a little bit worse now in terms of intensity, but I think it's very similar. But I'll give you a third way of people who deal with this. And this is more of the, you know, very noticeable in my experience. If Ford sees like a group of people protesting, you need security to hold him back from going out there and trying to talk to them and trying to convince them that he's actually an okay guy. And I think all these things are a reflection of these different leaders' personalities. The, you know, uncomfortable with conflict and human interaction Harper approach, the you know, fuck you, I'm an activist too, Trudeau approach, or the, you know, the somewhat you know, needy, I want everyone to love me approach of Ford. And like, these are three different approaches of three different leaders to the same stimulus, which is, you know, an angry protester or an angry mob. You gotta remember, all those pandemic people weren't very happy with the provincial government in Ontario when those lockdown measures were going on. They're not still chasing him around. Like, how you engage with these folks does actually have an impact on what comes next. It takes two to tango, or you know, as the saying goes, and I think that's true here.
Fungus has a PR problem. That's right. I said fungus. Massive comms issue. Used to be that fungi got all the credit it deserved for penicillin, delicious foods like cheese and bread, and lots of other medications. But lately, fungus is taking a hit. Put it down to the TV series and video game The Last of Us, in which a parasitic cordyceps fungus infects the planet, turning its hosts into super bitey spore zombies who try to infect any survivor they can get their cold, dead broccoli hands on. But fear not, Hurly-Burlyites. I and our presenting sponsor, Telus, are here to redeem fungi. Recall that I've been talking about Telus's Pollinator Fund for Good, their $100 million social impact fund that invests in startup, for-profit companies who have making the world a better place baked into their business model. Microcycle is one of those companies. They transform hard-to-break-down construction and demolition waste like asphalt, once destined for landfill, into valuable raw materials using, you guessed it, fungi. Now, I'm about the furthest thing from a mycologist, but they tell me that lab-cultivated fungi are applied to shredded waste materials, breaking it down quickly and turning it into biomaterial that can be rendered into new products for commercial or industrial use. Stuff like substitutes for styrofoam, insulation, packaging, and building materials, and multiple other applications where plastics had previously been used. Check this out. For every ton of waste diverted from landfills, Microcycle avoids almost 3 tons of CO2 emissions. And they're just getting started, with new strains being developed around rubber, gypsum byproducts, soil treatments, and other agricultural applications. I'd say that delivers on making the world a better place. See, fungus, we got your back. Take a well-deserved bow. Go to telus.com/pollinator to learn more. Jordan, follow up wherever you want to on that, but I just wanted to throw into the mix this. I think I'm going to prove Corey's point, which is that I don't really remember what the protests against Harper were like because I hated Harper and I didn't pay any attention to them. But it does feel different to me than in years past. Like I mean, both Mulroney and Pierre Trudeau and Kretchen all had a lot of people angry at them, a lot of people that would come out and yell at them. I don't recall ever seeing them in a situation where I thought they might be in physical danger. Like it was different.
I think the people who faced Kretchen in protests were more often in physical danger. But I have a hard time imagining Trudeau executing a Schwinnigan handshake. So, that's a different thing. But no, I think it is qualitatively and quantitatively different. And what changed, and some of this is being researched and tracked now by far smarter people than us who work on this and the issue of how, particularly since the pandemic and as many people became really sort of terminally online, spending more and more time online in these supercharged algorithms that only reflect back to people the biases that they're already bringing into social media spaces, it's juiced up and supercharged these communities in ways that just, frankly, wasn't even possible 5 to 10 years ago. So I think that that has changed. I think also that the pandemic provided a moment that really coalesced a community against Trudeau as a particular individual with a level of vitriol and focus maybe that is different from what we've seen in the past. And that coming with that, you have people who sort of have filtered into that community. And then once they get in there, you go deeper and deeper in, right? And it brings with it a whole package of beliefs and a whole package of, other kind of pain points with it. And so I think that that dynamic is new. And that is something that is dangerous and polarizing. And as we saw during the occupation here in Ottawa, frankly, like some elements of these groups are like 1 to 2 degrees separation from armed extremists, right? So it is, and that's new because in times past, if you wanted to become involved in a community that was opposing government, even in a really extreme way, like you had to turn up somewhere. You had to go use your real name. You had to turn up somewhere physically. You had to meet people in real life. And that's just no longer the case. So I think that that environment is new. But I will say, I think that the point about how each leader reacts to these protests and their own engagement with that dynamic is also really significant. And one thing that really strikes me, well, I guess I had two observations. So with respect to Belleville, and I will also out myself as a previous Belleville resident. I lived there for 10 years when I was a kid. Although it's funny because my reaction initially was like, oh, I'm not even remotely surprised that this happened in Belleville. So
nice. So,
maybe shout out to the 90s in Belleville.
Well, maybe the 70s were a genteel time.
I think the 70s might have been a more genteel time. But anyway,
all that yacht rock to keeping everybody mellow, Scott.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah,
Steely Dan, just keeping everybody down.
You bet.
The wheelhouse on the bay. There, you know, you had a few things. So that visual, right, of Trudeau going out from City Hall and wading into the crowd. When the Prime Minister tours, and he tours with the RCMP security detail, they're responsible for his security, and he simply like will not be going out into crowds without an assessment about what the level of safety is for that. And I think that we've seen from him in the past that he wants to go out sometimes into those crowds, and that he likes to maybe show those groups of protesters that he's not scared of them. I think this probably scares the ever-loving crap out of the RCMP with him for good reason. And I know that this is a dynamic that happened during the last campaign as well. And so that leaves me with the decision was made, knowing that those protesters were there, for him to go out regardless into that square, into that crowd. And I think somebody likely did that with the idea of a certain image in mind. Now, I want to be really clear. I'm not saying that I think he brought this on. I'm not saying that he asked for that. I'm not saying that he deserved that in any way. But I'm saying that in that moment, that calculation is not a strict security one. The leader's personality plays into it. And also decisions about optics play into it. And the second thing I want to say is about the last campaign, which is, I think, where we saw this dynamic play out just maybe in a little bit of a more concentrated format. Because the issue of vaccination and the way it was used by the Liberal campaign during the 2021 election, I think, was really instructive. So that is a known issue, that this is an absolute hot potato of an issue. It is known that when you are torquing that issue, that is something that's going to bring these groups out. And the decision was made to ramp up for the Liberals and for the Prime Minister specifically to push on that issue repeatedly. And it did turn up the pressure during the campaign. It turned up the pressure during the that created and fed more protests. And I think that in that case, that is like the clearest evidence that I can say that there was some intention behind that. Now, again, I want to be really clear. I'm not saying that he deserves that. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that there are two sides that are sort of going back and forth here. And then the final thing I'll say, I noticed this week, I thought the Prime Minister had more mojo in his appearances subsequent to Belleville than I've seen from him in a long time. I think that this gets him energized in a way that maybe other stuff doesn't. Now, maybe that's really fucked up, but I think that there is also something going on there that's about his own mentality and how he confronts these groups and how that feeds into his own sense of purposefulness in what he's doing.
But you touched Scott, on this. Scott, will you take off the idealistic young queen student who got involved in politics hat and put on the cynical, hardened political operative hat we're supposed to be wearing for today's show. Tell me, do you think these things hurt Trudeau or help him?
I'm not certain it has. I think it has a reinforcing effect for and against. I'm not certain that it has. Maybe it creates a mild degree of sympathy. I think, again, it might be something that contributes to his ability to fish in the NDP pond, because people look at that and they say, well, there's a line here and you're either on one side or on the other. And I think for a lot of NDP voters, they say, well, when I see that, my sympathies will ride to Trudeau. And that's just one step removed from being more able and more likely and more willing to vote for him in an election circumstance. So it might have that effect. I'll just throw one other thought onto the table. I'll come at it from a different angle. I'm also not saying that I think that Trudeau has encouraged this or deserves it. I obviously feel very differently. But I do think there's, you know, Corey raises an interesting point, which is if we can agree that the pandemic and the anti-vax community that got created online and got manifested, that that's that's a key component of it. It's had a catalyzing effect. It's had an assholizing effect. Then it's interesting. Corey's question is, well, how come Ford doesn't get it in the same way that Trudeau gets it? And I do think there's something unique. A lot of that is built on grievance politics. A lot of that is built on resentment of the establishment, resentment of those in power. And I think
working class men don't hate Ford the way they hate Trudeau.
That's right. So I think there's a unique quality to Trudeau that is almost inherent to who he is, not just his politics, not just his policies. I think there's a group of people that sort of look at him and go, that's 6'1". Great looking motherfucker born into privilege and to the manner born, right? He thinks he's better than me. Now, they're not, it isn't just a policy. Like, it isn't like they're like, and that's because of X, Y, and Z. And they don't have that same angry argument about big populist, chubby Ford. They don't. They look at Trudeau and they go, that's the kind of motherfucker who thinks he's better than me and is putting me down. And that stuff is rocket fuel to these folks. And they really, really use it.
We talked about this in the past too, like the idea that for sometimes this government, it comes off as though it's not just that they feel that they have the correct policy, that they have the morally right policy, and that they, and that their way of being, their way of living in the world is the virtuous one. And like that stuff is toxic, right?
But it's still wrong to stand in front of a 7-year-old and scream, fuck, fuck, fuck. And it's still wrong to fly a flag that has the maple leaf upside down. And the small town in me that I got from Prince Edward Hastings is never going to back down on that.
Scott, I think you're missing, I think the question here a little bit. I think for the same reason that the Shawinigan handshake did a lot for Kretchen in terms of positive branding, like how he interacted with a group of protesters and said, you know, and the message that was implicit in that was powerful and political. And I think that there's the same sort of thing going on here with Trudeau to an extent. And I agree with Jordan. I think he gets fired up when he does this. I think he gets motivated by it. I think I could see his staff saying there's some positives in creating those situations for him from time to time to get his blood up. But I think there's something more than that going on. I think it makes him look more masculine to actually engage with folks like this. I think he has a big deficit with men right now. I think he comes across as too much of a bit of a fancy boy who's the faux feminist, talking with this sort of breathy voice and speeches like that. All of that is off-putting to a whole lot of male voters. I think seeing him as more Trudeau the athlete, which he's capable of being, or Trudeau the guy who can get in a fight with you, or Trudeau the guy who, if you think back to the Brazo-Trudeau boxing match, he has flirted with these two different images of his leadership style and who he is. And you've seen different images of this put forward by himself and his campaign team at different times. And I think you're seeing more of the masculine fighter, Trudeau being trotted out for you. And I think there's a reason to do that right now. He has a big deficit with male voters.
Supply chains are the veins and arteries of Canada's economy. And if you'll permit me to extend that metaphor, there's plaque and sclerosis swirling around the system right now. Keeping our supply chains clear and healthy is a major preoccupation of our federal government and of our sponsor, CN. It's a frustrating job. Let me give you a little update on what's been happening. Weather. It remains practically impossible to load Canadian grain onto ships in Vancouver's perennial rain. Sustained rainfall creates bottlenecks that back up all the way to the prairies. A solution must be found. We're also in a severe global heat wave. Ultra-extreme temperatures have a crippling effect on some of Canada's trade partners. And here at home, they cause wildfires. And palls of smoke that hang over a big chunk of the continent. The climate is changing. I think we can all agree on that now. Managing its effect on supply chains is critical work. War. You may have read about Russia once again abandoning the agreement to allow safe export of Ukrainian grain. Quite simply, Russian aggression puts a direct strain on Canada's grain producers, and grain season here is beginning. Let me again refer you to the part about loading ships in Vancouver downpours. The pandemic. It may feel like it's over, but its effect lingers, particularly in Asia. Whether offshore supply chains will ever revert to normal is an open question. Whether we should onshore them is an even better question. And finally, a self-inflicted wound if there ever was one. A strike recently shut down the critical ports of Vancouver and Prince Rupert for nearly 2 weeks. Clearing the resulting backlog could take months. And if that's not enough, the dock workers may decide to walk off the job again. To be clear, CN invests a great deal of effort and money to navigate all these disruptions. But re-achieving normalcy is a work in progress. It's also a team sport. Bear with us, as they say.
But you know, if Chrétien could get away with the Shawinigan handshake, and it isn't just a complexion of the times, if Trudeau took the next step, if he actually ended up getting shoved and he tangled with somebody and he turned around and dropped a guy, I believe it would backfire on Trudeau. I don't think it would work.
Well, he beat up an Indian in Ottawa one time and went up in the polls, because that's what the Trudeau-Brazzo fight was it not? Like, you know, sometimes normal rules don't apply to this guy. And, he has gotten away with that as a method of projecting himself forward in a more masculine way in the past. And I think they did some of that in the last election campaign. I think it was very intentional to put their thumb in the eye of the unvaccinated in a way that was, I think, unbecoming. And I think it was intentional. And I think I think it helped them.
Is this a structural difference? Like, Jordan, are you going to be nervous about putting Jagmeet Singh out for walk-arounds in the next election campaign because he might get assaulted? Or is this just a Prime Minister thing or just a Trudeau thing or have walkabouts? I mean, one of the things Canadians in politics like to pride themselves on is that, you know, our political leaders can walk around the street, go to the grocery store, and other than maybe a selfie or two, they'll be fine, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm also struck by the difference in how Jagmeet Singh handles protesters compared to Trudeau. It is really now, and I will say, like, it's different because he tends to get like single hecklers or, you know, one or two. Like, he's not facing necessarily hundreds of people who are protesting him. So, like, I want to say that is different. But I think his method of dealing with hecklers or protesters is really distinct from what Trudeau does, right? He tends to, a bit like Ford, different, but the instinct is to engage them and to, you know, and to talk them down and to sort of use the goodwill in the room to his advantage. And I think he's often...
Doesn't always work, though, right? Wasn't there an ugly situation a few months ago? We talked about it where it almost did get physical with Singh.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't always work because, and frankly, I think a lot of the people who come out and heckle, you know, are like, these are not sort of people who
people
are
well, you can reason
right?
with.
Yeah, exactly. And so sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Although I would say that I think typically when there is video or images and stories about his handling of it, it does tend to reinforce his own positives, which is that he's affable and he's really able to diffuse these tense situations. And I think that his team has always been cognizant of his security because, to be honest with you, even well prior to the pandemic, being a visible minority leader attracted a certain type of attention. And so there is a built-in sensitivity to not putting him in unsafe situations. But, you know, also he himself is quite capable in handling those interactions. And I think it's also interesting that not unlike Trudeau, like, he's also a black belt, right? Like, these are guys who in their recreation time like to engage in martial arts, right? And I think that also gives them both, you know, maybe a certain confidence in wading into those situations. And I think we would be having also a bit of a different discussion for female leaders. Like, it is tough. And sometimes I think a little bit more about the people who surround the leader and a little bit less about the leader themselves, because particularly in the case of the Prime Minister, you benefit from clear and direct RCMP protection, and they're there to protect the PM. And when the campaign is on, other leaders will have that protection. But the staff, the journalists who are around these folks don't have really any protection. And so I think that sometimes decisions that are made about when to engage in crowds in certain situations, now the thinking does have to be a little bit wider about whether it's safe for the whole ensemble there.
It's a good thing I'm not prime minister, because if I had to fight my way out of a crowd, they'd be having a state funeral by the end of the week. So,
So just before we move on, I want to move on, but just before we do, you know, Scott Jordan has given me a hell of an idea here. I did not know that Singh was a black belt. Now, do you remember when Muhammad Ali fought that karate guy in the 70s?
I don't know if I do. Some I was mixed watching, martial arts. Ironically,
there was, a match Ali set up night. Between Muhammad Ali when he was champion of, against a mixed martial arts guy, and the guy just dropped to the floor of the ring and kicked Ali in the legs for 15 fucking rounds. So maybe this is, and Ali couldn't punch him because he was not standing up. Well, maybe this is going to be the Singh play in the next election campaign.
Yeah, he's I don't know what the rules are for Brazilian jiu-jitsu, but...
Well, I remember, anyone watch Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but the Brad Pitt conversation about who would win Cassius Clay or Bruce Lee with the faux Bruce Lee, that was pretty good. Anyway.
All right, anyway. We have a clipping today, and it comes to us courtesy of... Tonema Charles in the Toronto Star. It was last week. It was a setup piece for the cabinet shuffle that Nick Taylor Vasey of Politico tells us will not happen today, and I always trust Nick. And CBC News tells us will happen Wednesday, so we'll see if that is true. But nonetheless, here's what Tonda had to say after talking to a number of people she described as liberal insiders. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is expected to unveil a cabinet overhaul in the next week that will be less about a policy reset and more about a front bench makeover to execute promises and ensure the Liberals are in election ready mode. Conversations with key insiders suggest the minority Liberal government's real goal at this point is to craft a cabinet that perks up communications by putting more effective voices in key portfolios, to highlight what has already been done, and to deliver outcomes or results tied to big promises that have not yet been filled. Key players think the Liberal Party did not chart a path down a long enough runway ahead of the last two campaigns in 2019 and 2021 with strong players or strong messaging on key files. If part of the plan is to put more effective communicators in key portfolios, another part appears to be ensure that the right people stay in key jobs. That's why, according to sources, high performers like Chrystia Freeland in finance and the Deputy Prime Minister's office are not expected to move, nor are ministers where the files need ongoing stability. That suggests Melanie Joly will not move from foreign affairs. François-Philippe Champagne is likely staying in innovation, and Anita Anand is not expected to leave defense. So there you go. That's what we're apparently we're looking forward to. Jordan, what do you think?
I think that attaching the label high performer to Chrystia Freeland after this year is quite charitable, if not a bit detached from reality. But listen, I read that story and my takeaway was that, you know, the cognitive dissonance required to think that you can have a big, successful communications rebrand while also simultaneously not changing anything important is stunning. And I was struck in particular by the idea that they want to put better communicators in place to communicate about the things that have already been done. And that is loser talk. And so if that is their strategy, then I think they should just pack it in right now. Like, sorry to the people who were going to get shuffled into new portfolios and who might make it into the front bench, but this is doomed to fail. If that is the thrust of it, I think it's detached from reality. So they better have something else. It better be more major than what this story indicates. Or I think it's DOA.
Corey, we have bad comms is the tagline of every losing government, right?
Yeah. Well, everything's a comms problem in politics, right? The guys
we got in the a great story. Shop, we're just not getting it out there.
The guys in the policy shop kind of, you know, built like the perfect policy to blow up your voter coalition or to piss everyone in the world off. And the issues management guy can be on smoke break when the ATI is going out with the smoking gun in it. And it'll all land on the press secretary and the comms director's desk as just yet another comms fuck up by a government. So anyway,
all, I think we're getting close to some real life examples there, eh? You guess?
Yeah. Yeah.
A little PTSD.
A little PTSD. But in any event, like I, I think we're all probably going to agree on this topic, but like there are some bright points in terms of communications, and we've talked about this before. There are some people in that cabinet who are better at comms than others, just like there are in every government, and they tend right now not to be in highly public facing departments. Like so, well, in a couple cases, are I think Jolie's gotten better at comms, and she's more in that. Sean Payne thinks he's good at comms. I think he's like a cartoon character in terms of his presentation. I like to see a focus group where somebody listens to him speak for an hour and doesn't come away saying, Jesus Christ, get that guy off the stage. But I think Dom LeBlanc's very good. I think Sean Fraser's very good at comms. I think Seamus is very good at comms. Like he's a professional broadcaster for 20 years, whatever the number is. There are people who are good communicators, but they're not really in roles where they're out front and center. And you know what I think you should be doing in this kind of situation is going onto a campaign footing where you put your strongest communicators in the most public roles around the things you want to talk about the most. And you want to have, the Herb Grays of the world, the great old Gray Fog, for those who remember, in charge of the toughest files. So you don't want a good communicator in the sense of somebody who wants to go out there and be in front of every camera, taking over from public safety. You don't want to have someone like that. You want to have somebody who makes it go away. And, I look at examples of this in other governments. Like you want to have somebody who's going to be extra boring there, who's going to be a quiet manager and just take the temperature down on those files. But you sure as hell in this government need somebody who's good at communications in financial portfolios right now, because I think they're losing the ballot question on the economy. And at the end of the day, that's going to be the most important thing. So a shuffle that doesn't move Freeland, I think, is just, rearranging the furniture a little bit. It's not a home reno.
Yeah, I've certainly been on the record as agreeing with that a lot. But, I think we have to also acknowledge that some of these choices are more difficult than they appear. So if you take somebody like Guilbeault, for example, we're always crapping on him here because he's a lousy communicator in English, Canada, about their environmental policy. And they're going to have to defend their environmental policy if not run on it. And so he's not ideal. But in Quebec, he's a fucking rock star. Mm-hmm. Right? So in Quebec, they don't want to move him out of there. He's exactly the symbol in Quebec that they want. So, they have to sort of make a choice about what they want to do.
I don't think that's a problem. I don't think that's from a comms perspective. I think, I've been pretty outspoken in my criticism of him as an actual minister and about how he engages with provinces. But maybe going into a campaign, that's just what they need. Who knows? Like, I think I could make a case for it anyway. And I think I think they've been finding some elegant workarounds on resource issues and other issues, moving things like the 413 from something that's, led by the environment minister who doesn't want to do it and putting it in the hands of Dom LeBlanc, the infrastructure minister, who's a much more reasonable person on these things. I think they found a way to say, we can have our cake and eat it too on the environment. Somebody who's going to try to push that issue to the fore. And if you're the Liberals, you want to have environment as part of the ballot question for a lot of voters. And so it might make sense to have him stay there from a comms perspective. I think it's, from an operational perspective in terms of getting along with provinces and others, I think it's not good. But from comms, I think it is. But we'll see what they end up doing with this. But, it sounds, Tonda's, pretty connected in. And that sounds more like an official leak than it does, like an official framing of what's coming, as opposed to this person's going to this one and this one's going to that one. If you want to get what that is, it's usually talk to Fife. He's usually the closest. But, let's see.
Scott, it sounds like the government has completely accepted your assessment of their problem, but not applied it to the one place where you would apply it.
Yeah, that's exactly finance. Right. I mean, Freeland is too big to fail, right? I've made this joke before, right? And it's not a joke. It's a truthful statement, right? Like the banks in 2008, 2009, she's too big to fail. I do think she's a high performer. I think she's an essential minister in this government. I think she's absolutely fundamental to how this government functions. but I think she's one of their weakest communicators on the most important file. And when you have a prime minister who doesn't have a natural predisposition to talk about economics and to talk about it in a way that resonates with people, and you don't have a finance minister who has the ability to connect with people on that level, then you got a problem when the economy is indisputably, not just the most important issue, but the burning issue that will turn the next election. And so, I'll never say that cabinet shuffles don't matter, because I think that they always have all sorts of significant implications behind the scenes, if not in front of the cameras. But like, there are two fundamental questions. This leak, by the way, like as far as I'm concerned, I agree with Corey. This is orchestrated. This is and the clue to that is there have been no others.
You're saying the Prime Minister's office wants that story out. They wanted that framing of what they're doing.
Yes, but I think it's a confession, not a confidence. I think that I do not believe this spin, and I don't believe that they believe this spin. I believe that they know that this shuffle will not be what we would deem consequential, and I think they're just working backwards to try to have a structured analysis by a bunch of people that will be lazy on television and radio in the next few days, so that they can sort of gravitate toward that. They're hoping to influence sort of the orbit of opinion on this thing, because... and you'll hear it. You'll hear it on Wednesday all day long. You'll hear people saying, well, you know, what the Prime Minister's office is trying to indicate here is that, you know, yes, they want to strengthen their ability to communicate. So you've seen this minister who's a good communicator move to that ministry, which also doesn't matter compared to the one they have, but they've kept their high performers and essential and blah, blah, blah. So you'll hear this repeated, but it's bullshit. Like it's bullshit in the sense of what's really going on is just some surgery. They're going to drop some people for a bunch of reasons. I'm afraid that my buddy Marco is, you know, going to get demoted, and you know, they're going to make some changes along that line. And like if you've got somebody like Seamus as an example, we can all agree is a strong communicator. Fraser is a strong communicator. I don't think they're going to move them into a portfolio where that's going to actually alter it. Does it affect what the government does? Does it affect the government's electoral fortunes? Those are the two questions. And if the answer to one or both of those isn't yes, then the cabinet shuffle doesn't really matter from an external perspective. And I don't think the answer to either of those questions is going to be yes. You're going to have a housing. Effectively, they're going to make housing a full ministry. It's, you know, there are no such thing as junior ministers in this government. But really, housing is
a good example. I don't know the guy who's the minister, right?
Right.
But like, O'Regan broke through with me more in 3 days around this strike at the Port of Vancouver than the Minister of Housing has in 7 years on the fucking issue of housing, which is the number one issue in the country. I have no idea what he's ever said on that.
I wouldn't be
subject.
Surprised for that reason if Seamus or Fraser doesn't end up in this new vamped up Ministry of Housing.
Dom. I could see LeBlanc going there too, but...
Maybe. I think they like Dom where he is too, though. I think they like him as a fixer, and especially I think they see some Fed prob issues coming down the pike. But in any event, all of it's a long-winded way of saying this is, this construct and this spin is all built around of what they're doing.
Hasn't LeBlanc basically, from a functional perspective on the day-to-day news flow of the foreign interference file, being given Marco Mendicino's file? Is that not already happened?
Well, he's handed cleanup.
I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up as the minister, because he's essentially the acting minister today in terms of coming up with the terms of reference for, you know, whatever inquiry-ish thing comes out of this. So
can I just say
they're
one
already
small
making
thing?
An adjustment?
Can I say a vindictive thing? Just a vindictive, openly, brazenly, transparently vindictive thing. If Marco's going to take a punch in the head. And I recognize he has culpability and responsibility here, so I'm not being utterly blinded by friendship. But if he is, then the deputy minister said he had no idea that it was necessary to communicate this news to the minister. And the staff who stood next to him as he was drafting a statement of outrage and didn't bother to say to him, well, I actually knew about this 2 months ago, but I thought, you know, what the fuck? I hope those people also are held to account. They should fucking lose their jobs too.
Yeah, they won't. Yeah. that was a little bit of a useless vain there thing. So let me just go on to
say
one.
Therapy's in session today.
Exactly. It's just, but I've got my pillow that I hug.
Mm-hmm. So they've got in this article is this communications versus substance dichotomy laid out there, and I want to focus in on just one aspect of this, which is Mark Miller, who I'm interviewing later today for the Hurly Burly this week. And you know, this government has been the most ambitious government on Indigenous affairs in Canadian history. This government has spent more money on Indigenous affairs than any government in history. This government has stood up and defended and advocated and tried to change the language and tried to change the culture around this issue, to the detriment of its political position with a lot of white people in Canada. And Polera had a poll out, and Polera are the like the liberal pollsters, Stan Arnold. They had a poll out that showed that the Conservatives led vote intention among Indigenous Canadians, and the Liberals were in third place in support among Indigenous Canadians. And then Trudeau got booed at the Indigenous Games thing. I mean, so Mark Miller is, I would have thought, substantively the perfect person to have in there. He's an advocate. He has committed himself in a number of personal ways to this, and I think he's a pretty effective communicator. So what the fuck is going on here on this file? Like, I mean, it's just got to be soul-crushing. I mean, I know this is the most cynical, callous thing, because in the world of Indigenous heartbreak in this country, I'm talking about politics. But it has got to be soul-crushing for the government, having been as committed as it has been, to see results like that.
To do the right thing on Indigenous policy, you cannot get sucked into the fool's gold of thinking it's going to translate into votes, either with
100%.
Non-Indigenous Canadians or with Indigenous Canadians, because the community is complicated. Polling it is impossible. Trying to get it to vote is impossible. The community is not monolithic, to say the least. Look at the AFN leadership struggles. And so you can't be guided from a communications perspective by the desire for applause. That can't be what directs your policy. You have to be guided by a sense of, this is what I think is right, this is what I think is wrong, and I'm going to do it. And therefore, Miller's job, obviously, is to work as constructively as possible with stakeholders. But his number one job is to take tough positions and implement tough policy that is likely going to be unpopular with large swaths of the population, and not have it blow up in your face. Still have it be the 9th, 11th most important issue when it comes to people's vote determination. That is communication success. It is that you don't get punished for it, not that you get rewarded.
Yeah, I think it's impossible to imagine that there are any electoral cookies out there for doing well on this file, and it would be quite delusional to think so. But it's important. It's important to the government on a political level, and it's important from a fundamental justice point of view. And I think if you're the minister there, really the best that you can hope for in terms of the takeaway is that you're seen as a trusted broker. That's kind of your goal. There's going to be really difficult moments. You know, federal politics has got nothing on internal Indigenous politics in terms of the level of complexity and passion.
Nastiness
at all. And you know, frankly, just these issues are huge. And I think people's feelings reflect the enormity of the challenge, you know. And also, taking this file at the tail end of a decade of this government is really tough, right? Because we're past the days of the early optimism. We've seen that there are some issues impacting Indigenous communities in Canada that this government has not been able to successfully move on. And so you're left with all the tough components of that file. And there's very little in the way of low-hanging fruit for success. So I think in a lot of ways, it's probably one of the toughest files in government.
Well, for sure. But they did lay out very ambitious goals. If you're just to look at the boil water advisory stuff, and have invested enormous amounts of money. And, you know, it's like trying to fill a bucket that's full of holes. Like it, you know, no matter how many of these things they seem to resolve, that, you know, four more pop up. It's, you know, a lot of effort, a lot of money, and not a lot of progress against the stated objectives. And so, like, I think that makes it challenging. But, you know, I don't think it's going to be electorally significant one way or the other. You know, as we were joking, looking at that Polaro poll in our, you know, our WhatsApp chat, like, this is, you know, this is very, you know, very tough stuff, but the politics on it, you know, you're still going to see, I would predict, very low levels of participation in the election and large segments of the First Nations community, whether it's status or Métis or others. And then you'll see some other areas where you're going to see 99% of the vote go to one candidate or one party. And, you know, which, and in some cases, I think of, you know, my friend Jeremy Harrison, when he lost in northern Saskatchewan, where you have polls with 110% voter turnout. And all of that, you know, speaks to one of the other, you know, almost intractable problems within this area, which is level of political corruption in some corners of it, which is, you know, it's all very problematic stuff. I don't think there's a win here for anybody, but that doesn't mean that the efforts that this government or other governments have made in this area are without merit. They certainly are. This is one of the biggest problems for our country to focus on, but there's no pot of political gold at the end of it.
All right. Well, we're running out of time. We're running out of time, but Jenny would never forgive me if we didn't do a drive-by smear of Polyev on this show. So, so you know, I mean, overall this summer, he's had good poll. He's had good poll numbers. He's got outrageously good fundraising numbers, raising a shitload of money. Yet he keeps getting knocked off message by little things. And this week, it was. His description of somebody's house as a shack, and that seemed like an uncharacteristic mistake on his part. And the revelation that his campaign had paid the legal bills of the person who blew up Patrick Brown's leadership campaign. And this is maybe the kind of thing nobody's going to care about. We can get into that, but it certainly smells pretty aggressively bad. You know, on any of this stuff, basically, let me start with you, Corey. Any of this stuff matter? I'll just give you my point of view off the top, because I'm like that. Which is, I found in 2004 that a lot of stuff that we had gone through in securing the leadership and then putting together a government, whether it was the tactics that we took to win the leadership in terms of membership sales or delegate selection, all the way through to candidate choices and who we appointed and who we did not appoint, these things actually ultimately shaped perceptions of the government in ways that were unhelpful and in ways I didn't anticipate at the time.
Right. Yeah, and to relive those days, things with the Tamil community, for instance, I remember being fairly poignant. I think some of the vengeance against people who hadn't supported Martin in the leadership getting pushed out of cabinet positions, or treatment of Sheila Copps, for instance, being problematic. So yeah, I do think it can. I think in terms of the Shaq comment, I think that was noteworthy insofar as its rarity. Like, I think, I think Polyev has been almost pitch perfect on a lot of the stuff around economic narrative. And I think talking about housing and the price of housing and the value of the housing you're getting, I think that's all really smart stuff for him to be talking about. And I think he's been doing it very effectively. So this is an odd miss. And I think, you know, no one is ever going to be perfect on this stuff. And when you get it wrong, I think they had the exact correct issues management approach, which is apologize immediately and try to get back onto your narrative. You know, the stuff with respect to paying legal bills from leadership, et cetera, you know, I think that is not going to be consequential in the end. I think it's just such inside baseball, so not be important. But I do think it points to the same flaw in terms of campaign strategy that we're talking about with Martin, which is, you know, at the point that all that stuff was happening, it was clear Brown's campaign was going nowhere. He hadn't sold enough memberships to be a force. And and you could say maybe some similar things around some of the rhetoric around Charest, et cetera. you know, if you know you're likely going to win on the first ballot anyway, you know, you don't have to, you know, salt the earth with the bones of your adversaries in a way that that creates political risk for yourself. And I think that there's a bit of a desire to do that on Polyev's, you know, in Polyev's personality. I think he's somebody who likes to win. He's a competitor. And when he wins, he likes to win big and conclusively. And sometimes, you know, just because, you know, you're winning the hockey game and you're, you know, you're coaching your kid's team and it's 6-0, you don't just only put your stars on the ice and run the score up to 22-0. You know, it starts to look unbecoming at a certain point and starts to look unsportsmanlike. And I think that's something that they need to guard against a little bit in some of these areas, especially in terms of how they engage in intramural politics. There's going to be a lot of opportunities to get this right, you know, going through nominations, et cetera, and there are going to be opportunities to get it wrong. And I think, you know, being more magnanimous and trying to be more inclusive at this phase of the political cycle is always going to be to a leader's advantage. And I think that the test will be to see how they manage that. I don't know. I don't think it's consequential, as I guess the short answer.
Scott?
I think you've always got to be guided by the meta notion of what is the...
By the way, I'm just going to tell a little secret out of school. Scott was consistently the voice in the meetings that was articulating that we were being too aggressive organizationally and that it was going to blow back on us reputationally. Consistently said that and was consistently ignored.
I don't remember that. I will say in defense of myself, I can't hardly think of a person in politics I dislike more than Sheila Copps. I know it had an effect on the overall...
It did. No matter how we can justify it, I could spend a whole show explaining how perfectly motivated I was through that whole exercise, and it doesn't fucking matter. It hurt us.
It doesn't fucking matter. And I truly think she's an unlikable, irredeemable person. I think that she's not... I just don't like her. But it's always this, and to some degree, you know, that fundamental test of what's the perception you create is what I'm trying to say, which is that the meta thought is what's the osmotic impression you're putting out into the world about yourself. And it's vital for an insurgent opposition leader who is seeking to gain power, and because you're defining yourself each and every day. And so I'd say a couple things. One, you spend all your time kicking, sooner or later, chances are you're going to kick down. And that's what the Shaq thing was. And I think they corrected it right away. I was glad to see that they recognized that they were kicking down and it was okay to, maybe it's okay to be a prick all the time to Justin Trudeau, but you can't be a prick to some person who just lives in a modest home. And so they corrected that, but it's not going to help them because it reinforces the notion that, yeah, I think at base level, this guy's kind of a bastard, eh? Sort of a mean prick. Second, I don't think I already on social media, people are all going on and on about this Brown thing. I cry no tears. I think if they should have been transparent about the fact that they're booting the fees at the time and justified why they did in the same way that Jenny very rarely ever comments on the record, but she did for this article. And that to me is a tell, right? They wanted to explicitly say, no, what we did here was appropriate. And, you know, we had a woman who came forward. She was a whistleblower. She said she was seeing things she didn't like. She was being subjected to behaviors that she thought were wrong. And so we were going to support her. And I'm actually okay with that. I'm okay with them paying. I think they should have hung a lantern on it at the time. But you'll never get me to cry a single tear for Brown because I believe he was guilty of everything that they said he did and 10 times other things. He's a no good Nick. I think though, the big thing, you guys are going to laugh. I don't like the makeover. I don't like the makeover. I think if we're going to what's the osmotic signals that he's sending out there? The guy is Alex P. Keaton. I don't think you can go from that to the fellow who wanders, the 50-something-year-old guy who wanders around the Granite Club who just got divorced and is looking to shake 33-year-olds. It just doesn't, the look is off, okay? He needs a button-down shirt. Maybe get rid of the tie, right? But this kind of, it all looks forced. All of a sudden he's wearing a t-shirt. Oh, check me out. I want to show how
well-muscled. Have they tried a vest?
Huh?
Have they tried a vest?
A vest. There's just, and the eyeglasses, no, and his eyes are too far
apart.
Someone
supplied a kitten.
You can say I'm being cosmetic and superficial and we'd never have this discussion about a woman leader and all that kind of shit. I think that this makeover doesn't look right. It doesn't jibe. It's not right. And so, I'd be worried about that. It doesn't
fit with the persona, like when you put Paul Martin in a leather jacket.
Yeah. It's just, it's one step.
Well, as the guy wearing a blazer and a t-shirt routinely, including this morning, I think...
I don't like it. I don't like the makeover. That's all. And I'm no style guide, obviously. Check me out, right? But I don't like it. I don't think it's tracking.
Yeah. He looks better than he did. He looks better than you. That's
hard.
I hate to break it to you guys, but I don't think he's courting you.
I know, but I don't think it actually... You think women are looking at him and going, oh, okay, that's more approachable?
I have to say, I stumbled into like the most homoerotic part of Twitter right now, and it's Pierre Polyev convoy fans talking about the tightness of his t-shirt. Like, go there at your own risk. But it's out there. I'm just telling you. Like, there's a lot of brokiness of guys talking about how ripped Pierre Polyev is. But okay, so... Listen, did the makeover work? I mean, I think the problem with this, and this is not rocket science, but of course the question is authenticity. Can he pull this off? Is this who he actually is as a person? And of course it's not, because he is a nerdy, glasses-wearing guy who's kind of mean. Like, that's his being. That's who he has been for his entire public life, and I think probably prior to his public life as well. So I'm not persuaded that this is going to stick. I think that in terms of courting women, certainly it seems like the makeover was designed with perhaps a caricature of what women like in their male politicians in mind. But of course, his attitude and the tone is really, I think, far more significant. And that's why I actually, to go back to the Shaq comment, I think it's really bad. I think it's actually very damaging. And it's like comedy. He punched down. It's the cardinal sin. So it's one thing to make a case against people who are powerful, to use an example to illustrate your point, that puts somebody wealthy or somebody connected with it or somebody political. But this was a joke at the expense of a woman renter who's a server. It looked bad. And I think that it's actually a pretty big gaffe on the part of the staff team as well. Look, we've been in those meetings. You know, you're kicking around. It's the summer. Somebody on the comms team wants a concrete example. Okay, so if you're going to use a real person's house, you need to be really clear about this stuff. That is about doing your homework. Is somebody living there? What is the situation? And I also have questions just generally about the setup, like comparing it to Buffalo. Like, okay, sure, but like, do you want to live in Buffalo? Like, no. Like this.
It's not a real comparison. You're right.
That's right. And it doesn't. And I don't think it. And anyways, his point around housing and what he's trying to illustrate was entirely lost and was entirely blown away by the gaffe. And what has stayed, though, is the sense that it was mean and it was petty and that it looked down on, frankly, I think a lot of people and a lot of his potential voters who live in very similar houses. And so to my mind, it's worse than an error or a bit of laziness on the part of the staff team. Like, it's actually actively damaging. And so I think that's like a risk when you're personalizing examples like this that you really have to guard against, and that's a competence thing on the part of the team there. But if you're executing a makeover, like, you can't just make over the look. You need to also make over this guy's tone. And that's not happening.
Well, I think they've been trying to, in fairness, and I've noticed a marked change in terms of how he's presenting, like the, you know, I think
the lower voice, the lower pitched voice.
Well, but also the rhetoric. Like, I think he's dialed back the rhetoric a bit in a way that is noticeable, and I think that's smart. Yeah, like if we want to really dissect, you know, where did this error bite? It's that it invited a comparison to his own housing situation, and if you're going to highlight one person's housing situation, say, you know, well, this person's house is X, Y, and Z. You know, you're inviting a comparison to yours, and he does live in a 19-room mansion, you know, which was the point that I think Charlie Angus made, that, yeah, you know, I thought that was a very biting retort. You know, that said, this is an ankle biting error. Yeah, you know, an ankle biting retort, but it's Charlie Angus, so that's the kind you're going to get. But I think
take it to the bank.
I know. I know you can. But like, I think it's noteworthy in that it's an outlier in terms of how he's been able to communicate on this issue in particular. And I think it's the right issue. It's such a huge issue overall, but also with, you know, two key voter demographics, millennials and new Canadians. You know, it's the right topic to be talking about. Yeah, you know, that could have gone better, but I think you can adjust and get past that. I don't know. In terms of the image stuff, like this everything should be about, I believe, trying to increase this appeal to female voters, because that's where the gap is right now in terms of their voter coalition, in my opinion. But they're at least taking steps that I think are in the right direction. And, you know, it's always going to be tough to, totally change somebody's character. I get what you're saying about that, about who somebody is, et cetera. Like, there's always going to be some edge to polio. But, you know, you want to be taking steps to, I guess, dial that back. And, you know, I'll make the pitch again as to who I think should be out there throwing spears. And I think it's Melissa Lanceman, because I think, you know, she will come across to those voters you're trying to attack in a very different way. Then not just polio, but then almost anyone else that you could point to in that senior leadership cadre of MPs. I think she's the right person to be out there doing that, and I think you're seeing more of that too. So, you know, I think they're on the right strategic path. You know, maybe execution isn't perfect on every given day, but they're doing the right thing in my view.
All right, we gotta move on and wrap this thing up. I just do want to say one last interesting thing about this is that. Very notably at the time, Preston Manning did exactly this makeover, removed his glasses and changed the hairstyle and tried to soften up the image. And all of these people, from Poilievre to his team, Jenny et al., would have seen that close up and how that went down. In his case, it didn't work. And I think it probably didn't work because of his voice as much as anything. In any event, Hey Yous, Corey, do you got one? Mr. Pinson, it's time for our Hey Yous.
Ladies and gentlemen, please return to your seats. The Hey Yous are about to begin.
I sure Corey? Do.
Yeah.
My Hey You is to Shuvalay Majumdar, who's running for the Conservative Party in Calgary Heritage. I think he's going to be elected. And Shuv is somebody I've known for many decades. I think he's one of the smartest people I've encountered in politics and in political life. And I think he's going to really add something to that caucus and to that team. And I think he's going to be able to speak very credibly on foreign affairs issues. I think he's somebody who's got a lot of experience in that realm. I'll say this as well. He, you know, when we're talking about tone and all of that, Shuv is a happy warrior. And he's somebody who puts a really nice tone and a really nice presentation around a lot of issues that I think will be to the betterment of the party and to their overall re-election or election efforts, rather.
Cool. Excellent. Jordan?
Well, another week, another Hey You to Heather Stephenson on the issue of searching the landfill. You've now had another week to think about what a bad decision this is and what a politically costly mistake it is to say no to the search. And in fact, this week we saw the union of the workers in the landfill come out and say that the search could be done safely and still protecting their workers. There is no reason to prevent this from happening. And the message is terrible. I think
there is, though. Can I make an argument on this?
No, not done yet.
I think there is.
Hold on. I think it's politically damaging for her. So it's a dumb move that way. But more than anything, it sends the message to Indigenous people in Manitoba that their lives are worth less. It's gross. Now you can go.
If it's $180 million to do the search, is that compared to other things that you could do? Do you know how many
shelters
you could buy for that?
What if it was your kids?
Well, but your job is
get to a make second tough bid. Tough to get decision. A second bid, for Christ's sake. I don't believe it costs $180 million.
Well, okay, but you know, it's, I'm not sure this is politically damaging for them. I think,
well, I guess we're going to find out, huh?
Well, you know, like they were on the path to not being reelected not that long ago, and they've done a lot to close the gap between themselves and the NDP. I'm not sure this is unintentional, and I'm not sure that it is, you know, you may find it morally
all the more distasteful
to yourself, but I'm not sure that it's politically stupid. That's a different argument.
Yeah, Jordan, I'm on your side substantively, but I worry about Corey being right politically.
I'm on Jordan's side, and I think Jordan's analysis is correct too. It's going to hurt her. My Hey You is an appeal. It's an emotional, personal, not hard edge political appeal. It's just a flat out personal appeal to the Prime Minister and those around him making decisions in the next 48 hours about cabinet. Look, you gave Sajjan a demotion, a soft landing. Jolie was booted to the outer rim and then brought back right into the inner orbit. You're looking at Marco Mendicino this week. I know the guy's got to move. But move him. Don't dump him. You know, give the guy an opportunity. His hard industry, his good instincts, his good, strong heart. Give the guy a chance to build back. If he doesn't, he doesn't. But give the guy a chance to build back. Don't kneecap him. The Prime Minister's office knew about this fucking Bernardo transfer too. And, you know, that didn't blow up in everybody's face in the same fashion. He's got to take some responsibility for what went down there on this and other files. But give the guy a chance to build back. Put him into a lower portfolio and give him that chance.
Build don't back just better? Him.
Build, to build back better. Give him that chance. But I really do mean it. Like, you know, like Jesus Christ, the Sajjan's still in cabinet. Marco deserves a chance to claw his way back too.
Well, although you could take that the other way, which is what the fuck is Sajjan still doing in the cabinet?
Well, there's that argument, but this is a relative this is a relative measuring stick I'm putting, not necessarily an objective.
What a world.
I'm in the same direction. I'm calling out to the Prime Minister because, oddly, he's not returning my calls, so I'll just use this mechanism. And just say, listen, you got two guys in your cabinet. Sean Fraser and Seamus O'Regan, who take any portfolio you give them and make it an economic portfolio. And I know more about what the government's trying to do in economic strategy from those two people than I do from the people that are actually in economic portfolios. So give them economic portfolios and let them run. If you believe in what you told Tonda McCharles, put those people in the window on the economy. All right. That's our show for this week. Thank you for watching or listening. Thanks, Corey, Scott, and Jordan for being here. Lots of fun. I'd like to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, and our sponsor, CN Rail. And we will see you all back here next week, Accursed, with a real cabinet shuffle and more of the Curse of Politics. See you then.